Okay, well, thank you for that generous introduction. As Laura said, and we all know, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge are expecting a child in July. Now, presumably, those parents know the sex of their baby, but we don't, or at least I don't. And the baby, when he or she is born, will become third in line to succeed to the throne. Under the Succession to the Crown Act of 2013, this year, to which royal assent was given in March, for the first time, succession to the crown will no longer be determined by gender. So that, whether the Duke and Duchess have a boy or a girl, that child will continue to be third in line to the throne, whatever the gender of other children who might be born to them later. Now, while the media, as Laura pointed out, are very excited about subjects like the sex of the baby, it's no longer of constitutional significance, thanks to this act. Nevertheless, when Hilary Mantel, the Booker Prize-winning author of Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, gave a London Review of Books lecture in February this year on the subject of royal bodies, she discovered that remarks about Kate, the Duchess of Cambridge, were politically a highly sensitive subject. The Prime Minister, no less, gave an interview to the BBC in Delhi, condemning Hilary Mantel's remarks about Kate as completely misguided and completely wrong, although clearly he had not heard or read the lecture in question. So, though the Succession to the Crown Act 2013, redefining the rules governing the order of succession, provoked remarkably little media attention or public controversy before it received royal assent in March, the same is not true of comments in a public lecture about the way in which the press imposes its own narrative about royal bodies on females of breeding age. The second part of Hilary Mantel's lecture was, in fact, devoted to Tudor royal bodies and the way that the story of Henry VIII and his wives is told. To quote her, "The history of the reign is so graphically gynecological. The bodies of Henry's wives, the focus then and now of commentary and gossip on their attractiveness, their reproductive failures mostly, and the occasional successes. The parallels with our modern obsession with royal bodies and celebrity culture are not hard to find here. And the intersection of royal scandal and media frenzy is a theme that Mary Fussell will be picking up in next week's lecture. Hilary Mantel was keen, ironically enough, to turn the focus away from Henry's wives and focus instead on Henry VIII's own body and his obsession with getting an heir. And what I propose to do today is to extend this line of approach to Henry's predicament, looking to explain his outlook and actions in terms of the fragility of the Tudor dynasty, the threats it faced, and the resources that Henry drew on in his quest for a male heir, medical, religious, and political. During the reigns of the Tudors, between 1485 and 1603, there was never a time when the matter of the royal succession was not at the center of national and international politics and religion. And of course, eventually, the Tudor line ran out of direct heirs, and Queen Elizabeth was succeeded by King James VI of Scotland, first of the Stuarts. The fragility began with the circumstances in which the Tudor dynasty was established. What you're looking at on the screen is a manuscript commissioned possibly by Henry VIII himself, but certainly written and painted in London, in Westminster, in 1511, showing the royal families of England, right going back to Brutus and the Trojans, and going forward right to the present, as it were. Because on the right-hand bottom side, you're looking at the bottom of the tree, and you're looking at the family of Henry VII. And in fact, you can see that in rather more detail in this image, which shows you Arthur and Henry, the two sons, eldest sons at the top, and then Edmund, the younger son, and then daughters below. When Henry Tudor sees the crown, surprisingly, at the Battle of Bosworth Field in 1485, his claim to the throne was no stronger than that of several other possible contenders. His reign was one extended succession crisis, facing up to military challenges from pretenders to the throne who claimed to be Richard, Duke of York, one of the princes in the Tower who had disappeared in 1483, or from the background threat of rival claimants with lines of descent going back to Edward III in the 14th century. And this is Henry VII. On Henry VII's death in 1509, one claimant, Edmund de la Pole, the third Duke of Suffolk, was still imprisoned in the Tower of London, and other members of the same family were at large in other European capitals. Henry VIII took the precaution of eliminating Suffolk by execution when he went to war in France in 1513. He also celebrated publicly the death in battle of Suffolk's younger brother, Richard de la Pole, in 1525. Another powerful dynastic rival, Edward Stafford, Duke of Buckingham, who was descended both from the Lancastrian and the Yorkist members of the royal family, was executed by Henry in 1521 for not much more than listening to prophecies about Henry's death and his own succession to the crown. So Henry VIII's desire to beget a male heir was driven in part by his awareness of the strong claims of other families to the throne, claims that would be immeasurably more powerful if he had no direct heir, or even had only a female heir, who might, after all, be married off to another dynastic line or to a rival European monarch. So that's one kind of threat that determined Henry VIII's mindset. But 1485, the year that Henry VII had seized the throne, was also the year of another invasion, the arrival of the so-called English Sweat from France. A Norman physician of the time, Thomas Forestier, talked metaphorically of this disease as an invading army under banners, just like that of Henry VII in the same year. This new epidemic disease took the form of a fast-acting fever that was thought to be particularly virulent in court circles and revisited England at intervals every few years. The threat this posed to the Tudor dynasty was made very obvious by the royal tragedy of 1502. This is a later engraving of the three eldest children of Henry VII. So Prince Arthur is in the center, Henry himself is on the left, and Margaret, the eldest daughter, is on the right. We need to remember that Henry's older brother, Arthur, had been the Tudor heir until he was suddenly carried off by illness a few months after his marriage to Catherine of Aragon. He died at Ludlow in the Welsh borders in 1502, and this is Arthur. The cause of his death at age 16 is not known for sure, but it seems to have been some kind of complaint of the lungs. Arthur and Henry's youngest brother, Edmund Tudor, Duke of Somerset, had already died in infancy in 1500. Now, so the English sweat preoccupied not just Henry, but all those connected to the Tudor court. This is a chronicler's account of the 1517 visitation of the sweat. The king appointed his guests for his pastime this summer, but suddenly there came a plague of sickness called the sweating sickness that turned all his purpose. This malady was so cruel that it killed some within 3 hours, some within 2 hours, some merry at dinner and dead at supper. Many died in the king's court, the Lord Clinton, the Lord Grey of Wilton, and many knights, gentlemen, and officers. For this plague, Michaelmas term was adjourned, and because that this malady continued from July to the midst of December, the king kept himself ever with a small company and kept no solemn Christmas, willing to have no resort for fear of infection, but much lamented the number of his people, for in one town half the people died, and in some other town the third part. The sweat was so fervent and infectious. Not surprisingly, Henry VIII was most in fear of catching the English sweat himself, or for that matter, the other great epidemic threat of the period, the bubonic plague. This too was a regular visitor to England during Henry's reign. If Henry were to succumb to one of these diseases, and he had no heir in place, the dynasty would be finished and the crown would be seized by the strongest claimant. Henry took every precaution he could to protect himself. The most effective precaution was to remove himself from the vicinity of the outbreak whenever anyone connected to the court caught a suspicious ailment. As a result, Henry, more than any English monarch before or since, moved from palace to palace, or better still, from hunting lodge to hunting lodge, or to the houses of courtiers in the country, whenever disease threatened. At the height of his love for Anne Boleyn, in June 1528, one of Anne's women went down with the English sweat. Henry left Anne immediately and moved from safe house to safe house until the danger was over. Anne was left behind at Hever Castle, in quarantine, effectively, and Henry sent his doctor, William Butts, to her. And this is Holbein's portrait of William Butts. Both she and Butts seem to have caught the sweat, but both survived it. Henry's own interest in medicine was well developed, and he has left some of his personally attested remedies in a manuscript book alongside others recorded by his doctors. Henry was also the king who gave the Royal Charter to the College of Physicians of London, known for some time as the King's College of Physicians, in 1519. On the model of similar colleges with licensing powers over medical practice in Florence and Milan. Henry was also later to be central to the unifying of the Worshipful Company of Barbers and the Guild of Surgeons in 1540. And here's Henry seated in the middle, granting the charter with his physicians on this side and his surgeons on the other side. So in 1540, the, the joint companies formed the Company of Barber Surgeons under the protection of the king. So the twin threats of dynastic rivals and disease were two powerful drivers of Henry's actions, both personal and political. But what I've described so far might best be thought of as defensive measures designed to protect the dynasty against threats from outside. How did Henry succeed with his principal aim, that of getting an heir, and if possible, at least one spare? On succeeding his father in 1509, Henry straightaway married his brother Arthur's widow, Catherine of Aragon. Earlier, Henry VII had taken the precaution of securing a dispensation from the Pope to allow a marriage between Catherine and her deceased husband's brother. After the death of Arthur, it had been assumed by many that he might have left Catherine pregnant. That the marriage of Arthur and Catherine had been consummated was taken for granted by Henry VII and by Pope Julius II, because the marriage ceremony alone between Arthur and Catherine would not have constituted consanguinity under church law, and thus would not have required a papal dispensation, which was what Henry VII got. Anyway, Henry VIII and Catherine were crowned together, and soon Catherine was pregnant. She miscarried a girl on the 31st of January 1510. A boy named Henry and created Prince of Wales was born on New Year's Day 1511, but died 6 weeks later. A series of miscarriages and stillbirths followed. Only on 18th of February 1516 was a healthy child born, Princess Mary, who survived infancy. Catherine's last delivery in November 1518 was a stillborn daughter. So, no male heir, after perhaps six pregnancies in total for Catherine. As we know, it was much the same story once Henry had divorced Catherine and married Anne Boleyn. A series of pregnancies, miscarriages, and stillbirths, and one healthy female princess, Elizabeth. So, what was going wrong, seen from Henry's perspective? Only four of the eight women Henry is known for certain to have slept with conceived. His first male child, who lived into his teens, was Henry Fitzroy, born in 1519 and acknowledged as his child by Henry and created Duke of Richmond and Somerset in 1525. Giving him precedence at the court over everybody except any future legitimate son. His mother was Elizabeth Blount, who was Henry's mistress from 1514 or 15 for about 8 years, but she had no further children by Henry. After she married in 1522, she did have two further sons and a daughter by her new husband. Henry Fitzroy died in July 1536 of consumption, age 17, just as his father seems to have been on the point of making him his heir after the execution of Anne Boleyn. By his third wife, Jane Seymour, Henry became a father at last of a second son, Edward, in October 1537. This is the rather charming portrait of a very small Edward, who immediately became his legitimate heir. This was after 28 years of what Henry had come to see as unlawful matrimony, first to Catherine and then to Anne. Jane Seymour died of complications after giving birth to Edward. Given the doubtful survival prospects of his infant son, Henry's quest for a male heir was far from over. So how would these difficult issues of conception, bringing a baby to term, the sex of the child, and survival of the child at birth be seen from Henry's perspective? One answer can be had by looking at Henry's use of images of himself. The key work here is the great Hans Holbein mural that Henry commissioned and had painted on the wall of his privy chamber in Whitehall Palace in 1537. It commemorates his third marriage to Jane Seymour and his hopes for an heir to the Tudor dynasty. Unfortunately, the painting itself was lost in a fire in 1698, but a copy of the painting survives. Made in 1667 by Remigius van Lienput. The painting shows Henry VII and his wife Elizabeth of York in the background up there, and Henry VIII and a probably pregnant Jane Seymour in the foreground. Henry's pose, with his legs spread, his hands on hips, and elbows akimbo, facing the viewer out of the picture, is very confrontational and matches the assertiveness of the text written on the pillar at the centre of the picture. It reads, in part, "The son," meaning Henry himself, "born indeed for greater tasks than his father, from the altar removed the unworthy and put worthy men in their place." So the implication is the son is greater than the father and has purged the church. Holbein's own cartoon sketch for the left-hand side of this picture survives, and here, if anything, the pose is even more dominating. This picture was in turn the inspiration for a whole series of individual portrait figures of the king, each presenting Henry the same way. And I'll show you them quickly. This one's in Trinity College, Cambridge. Now, I want to isolate the feature at the centre of Henry's pose in all these portraits. And that is the codpiece. Now, the codpiece was not just a fashion accessory of the day, but a way of emphasising that the cods, the testicles, that stored the male seed, were key to his identity. So one answer to the question of Henry's attitude to the problems he encountered with getting the male heir the Tudor dynasty lacked is that he acted out his own potency in symbolic terms, facing down those who gossiped about the lack of an heir. But what about the practical issues? Coping with the problems of conception, of miscarriages and stillbirths. These were matters of generation, as they would have been described in the language of the time. They were not really private matters, in the sense of their only involving the two people most obviously concerned in each case. Thus, at the trial of George Boleyn in 1536, he gave evidence that made it clear that rumours of Henry's inability to have sex with George's sister Anne were circulating at court. The king's physicians, we've met William Butts, and this is Robert Chamber, testified on Henry's behalf when he was trying to prove that he'd not been able to consummate his marriage with Anne of Cleves in 1540. Stories about the problems in carrying children of Catherine and of Anne were spread by Spanish and Venetian diplomats. So hardly a private matter. But what if we could get close to the sort of medical advice and resources that Henry himself could draw on? We are fortunate to have the notebook of one royal physician, in fact, the only notebook known to survive from the Tudor dynasty, belonging to a royal physician. The writer was John Argentine, who became physician to Henry's elder brother, Arthur. And this is the brass of Argentine that's in King's College Chapel today, the only surviving image of him. Argentine was educated in Cambridge and at Ferrara in Italy, and had been physician to the two princes in the Tower. In fact, he was the last man to see them alive. His notebook is full of remedies for illnesses that his royal patients might catch. But it's remarkable for the number of entries it has for problems to do with generation. It has sections on coitus, sex, and conceptio, for example, but also for menstrual flow, difficult births, fetus, impregnation, womb, pregnancy, and sterility. In order to provoke coitus, there is a herbal concoction recorded by Argentine, invented, he said, by the Franciscan friar, William Holm. The Franciscans were notorious in this time for their interest in sexual matters. If there are difficulties in achieving sexual congress, says Argentine, you should take precautions against maleficia, that is to say, spells or charms designed to interfere with sex. You should wear hypericon, that is St. John's wort, on your person because of its power to counter these maleficia. There are separate entries in the notebook for demon and maleficia that contain amulets against the incantations of others that would prevent sex taking place. Argentine's own favourite method of preparing his male subject for sex, and I'm sorry, this is going to be completely illegible, but that's the point, really. It's scrawled in Argentine's own hand in this notebook, and it's very hard to read, I can tell you. His own favourite method of preparing his male subject for sex is to take the testicles of a goat, cook them well, and then cut them into tiny pieces. Then mix with egg white and ground marjoram, and shape the mixture into an apple, and give it to the subject to eat. It does wonders, says Argentine. And if you add bull's testicles, it will be even more powerful. For conception to take place, you need to prepare the woman if her womb is too cold. Take a handful of sage, onion, half as much of rue, extract the juice and give it to the woman to drink, as much as she can with a little salt. Then she will have sex and conceive without doubt. Argentine describes this as tried and tested. Once the woman was pregnant, there were ways of protecting her against the misfortune of miscarriage or a dangerous birth. There was, for example, the eagle stone, or aetetes. And this is one actually mounted in a silver brooch to be worn about the neck of the woman. The eagle stone was a hollow stone with another inside it that could be heard to rattle. Symbolically, it mimicked the fetus in the womb. At the time of the birth, it needed to be tied to the woman's thigh because it had the power of attracting the fetus to it. There were also what Argentine called experiments, in effect prognostic devices for telling the future, for finding out whether the man or the woman was at fault in a failure to produce children, often involving the use of urine specimens from both parties. There were other experiments to determine the sex of the yet unborn child and the outcome of a pregnancy for both mother and child. These medical and prognostic resources, and many others, would have been put at the disposal of the king in his quest for a male heir. During Henry's reign, the first manual on generation was printed in England in 1540, with a second edition in 1545. It was a translation of the Latin edition of a work by a German doctor, Eucharius Roslin, and its English title was The Birth of Mankind. The complexities of this book have been worked out by Elaine Hobby in her edition of The Birth of Mankind in 2009. The original version had been addressed specifically to midwives, but the English 1545 text has a prologue for women readers, and the translated material is implicitly aimed at mothers-to-be. Richard Jonas, the translator, also added a further section on fertility problems that had not featured at all in Roslin's work, and which applied both to men and to women. This section of the book is based on exactly the kind of experiments and remedies found in John Argentine's notebook. The whole work was dedicated to the new queen, Catherine Howard, on its first publication in 1540. And intriguingly, there is even a tiny initial portrait of King Henry himself in the 1545 edition, wearing his imperial crown with a rose and crown above him. I hope you can see it. No doubt Jonas and his publisher hoped and maybe even expected royal patronage to come their way for this printed manual on generation. Henry's interest in generative matters we can assume to have been consistent, even as his ability by the 1540s, when this book was published, to father children was in decline. Henry's problems have also attracted the attention of modern medical specialists who've tried to diagnose the underlying causes using up-to-date understandings of human reproduction. In the late 19th and early 20th century, the favorite theory was that Henry had become syphilitic, and that he in turn infected his wives, thus damaging both the wives and the children they hoped to bear. This idea fell into disfavor once the lack of the characteristic symptoms of syphilis and Henry's tendency to serial monogamy were taken into account. More recently, the science of genetics has been brought to bear on Henry VIII. Two American scientists, Katrina Banks Whitley and Kyra Kramer, have published an article, followed by a book, arguing that Henry might have been positive for the Kell antigen on his red blood cells. Someone who is Kell positive, a genetic trait that occurs pretty infrequently in the population as a whole, will cause reproductive difficulties for a Kell negative sexual partner. While she may successfully conceive and bring to term a Kell-positive baby once, succeeding pregnancies will likely result in the mother's body, once sensitized, developing an immune reaction that will cause her body to reject a baby that is Kell's-positive. This could account for the way in the way in Anne Boleyn's case that she successfully gave birth to Elizabeth, but was then unable to bring other children to term, and also perhaps the case of Jane Seymour, who bore a healthy boy. It fits the case of Catherine of Aragon less well, since she miscarried her first child, and Princess Mary was born of her second pregnancy. Of course, her first baby could have been Kell negative, but in making that kind of exception, the application of the theory begins to seem as if it requires too many guesses based on limited real data. In general, it seems that the technique of retrospective diagnosis throws rather more light on the scientific fashions of the present than it does on the bodies of Henry VIII and his wives. But the medicine of his own time was not the only resource available to Henry VIII. He could draw on his religious faith and the intercession of the Blessed Virgin Mary and the saints on his behalf to help him in generating an heir. Henry's own mother, Elizabeth of York, is known to have made offerings at the shrine of the Virgin, Our Lady of Pew, at Westminster, and to have paid a monk to fetch the girdle of the Virgin herself from Westminster when the Queen was pregnant with Catherine Tudor in 1502. Sadly, both Queen and baby died as a result of this birth. This terrible outcome doesn't seem to have affected Henry's own belief in the protective powers of the Virgin. He is known to have owned and written his name on a long parchment roll to be attached to the body of the woman in childbirth. And this is just a small section of the roll. This roll invokes the aid of the Virgin as protector in a central image of the Virgin and child, as well as of Christ himself, as we see in this section of the roll. The text written in red that you might be able to see to the left of the image of the crucified Christ reads, "And if a woman be in travail of child, lay this on her body, and she shall be delivered without peril, the child to christening, the mother to purification." A birth girdle of this type was also printed in 1533 in London by Wynkyn de Worde, thus making it much more widely available. As well as invoking the help of Christ and his mother, these birth girdles typically carried prayers invoking the intercession of St. Margaret and two saints with a specially English following, Saints Quiricus and Julita. All three saints were strongly associated with childbirth. Henry's devotion to the Virgin in relation to childbirth was as strong as his mother's. After the birth of his infant son, christened Henry on New Year's Day 1511, Henry rode straight away on horseback from the palace at Richmond to Walsingham in Norfolk and gave thanks at the statue of the Virgin of Walsingham, leaving there a necklace for the Virgin as a thanks offering for the safe delivery of his heir. Later, after Henry VIII had broken with Rome and had been declared supreme head of the Church of England, and when the English monastic houses were dissolved and the practice of pilgrimage forbidden, Henry was still ready to intervene in 1539 to prevent reforming bishops cracking down on midwives who were using rituals and objects associated with devotion to the Virgin. What is most striking about Henry's religious beliefs when it came to the question of generation is that he was always committed to the idea that the outcome of his quest for a male heir was a sure sign of God's blessing or otherwise on his marriages. A portrait of Henry in his own prayer book, illuminated for him for his own use. And he casts himself, as it were, as the figure of David, opposite the text for David in the prayer book. By the mid-1520s, Henry had convinced himself that the death of his infant son, Henry, in 1511, and the later history of Catherine of Aragon's pregnancies, even including the birth of a healthy Princess Mary, indicated that the marriage itself was not favoured by God. The reason it was not favoured was clear enough to Henry. The dispensation that the Pope had given for his marriage to Catherine was not valid because she had consummated her relationship with Arthur. And as it said in Leviticus 20:21, "If a man shall take his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing. He shall be without children." This was later interpreted by Henry to mean without sons. Henry's insistence that the Pope should declare his predecessor's dispensation invalid and the marriage to Catherine not a marriage at all was the sticking point. When it became clear that the Pope, under pressure from Catherine's nephew, the Emperor Charles V, would not annul the marriage, though it turned out the Pope would have been willing to allow Henry to marry Anne Boleyn bigamously, the path to Henry's declaration of himself as supreme head of the church in England was set. Once Archbishop Cranmer, who accepted the royal supremacy, declared on behalf of the church the marriage to Catherine to be null, Henry was free to marry Anne Boleyn and insist legally that Princess Mary, his child by Catherine, was illegitimate and would not succeed to the throne. Sadly, the same scenario presented itself once Queen Anne had failed to produce a male heir. When the Queen miscarried again in January 1536, probably of a son, Henry convinced himself that God had given his verdict on this second marriage too. Within a couple of months, the Queen had been accused of adultery with a number of courtiers, including her own brother. Henry declared in public that she had procured his love by use of enchantments, and Archbishop Cranmer stated the second marriage too to be null and void, on the grounds that Henry's previous sexual relationship with Anne's sister Mary invalidated the marriage to Anne. The analogy with Catherine's own relationship with Arthur is clear. Thus, Princess Elizabeth too found herself excluded from the succession as an illegitimate child. While Henry's headship of the church and the compliance of Archbishop Cranmer enabled the king to make his own daughters illegitimate in the eyes of the church, Henry also used parliamentary means to determine the order of succession. The first Succession to the Crown Act was passed by Parliament in March 1534 and made the then yet unborn Princess Elizabeth, daughter of King Henry VIII by Anne Boleyn, the true successor to the crown, by declaring Princess Mary, daughter of the king by Catherine of Aragon, a bastard. The act also required all subjects, if commanded, to swear an oath to recognise this act as well as the king's supremacy. The second Succession Act of Henry VIII's reign was passed by the Parliament of England in June 1536, removing both Mary and Elizabeth from the line of succession. The Third Succession Act of the reign, passed in July 1543, returned both Mary and Elizabeth to the line of succession behind Prince Edward. This was effectively to recognise that Henry could no longer expect a spare male heir, and to ensure that if Edward died before begetting his own male heir, the Tudor dynasty would survive at least through the female line. And you can see how that worked out in this great portrait of Henry with Jane Seymour and Prince Edward in the centre, and the two princesses partitioned off on either side, clearly not the key people, but still there, but off to one side. And this is the central image of the king with Jane Seymour and Prince Edward. Fortunately, much less was at stake in the Succession to the Crown Act 2013, since the current line of succession to the throne is long and both males and females may succeed indifferently. The political fallout from the quest for an heir was far from complete with the matters of the church. In the course of the twists and turns that had brought Henry to the position he reached by the Third Succession Act in 1543, he'd managed to overturn the papal supremacy over the English church, set the English on a religious path to be determined solely by himself and his advisers. He'd broken his alliance with the emperor against the French in order to marry Anne. The quest for an heir destroyed three of his principal advisers: Cardinal Wolsey, who had tried and failed to procure a papal annulment of Henry's marriage to Catherine; Thomas More, his chancellor, who would not subscribe to the Act of Supremacy and was executed under the Treasons Act of 1534; finally, Thomas Cromwell, who had brought about Anne's downfall and forged the marriage with Anne of Cleves, and was then indicted for treason, heresy, and plotting to marry Princess Mary. Cromwell's fate will be the subject of the third volume of Hilary Mantel's trilogy on Thomas Cromwell, which will end with Cromwell's death before Henry got himself a legitimate male heir at last in 1537. So what I hope I've done in this lecture is show how Henry VIII's quest for an heir brought together medical perspectives on generation, belief in intercession and amulets, and a conviction that God would sanction any religious or political measure by the king that would secure the continuance of the Tudor dynastic line. Thank you.